Welcome to the My Morning After podcast. Before we get to the juicy conversation, please bear with us while we get through some essential information. It'll only take about 30 seconds. I promise. The My Morning After podcast is brought to you by Ella One, the most effective morning after pill. Ella One film-coated tablet for emergency contraception and contains Ulipristal acetate. Always read the label. Verify the most effective morning after pill claim at ellaone.co.uk/verify. The opinions you're about to listen to in this podcast belong to the individuals expressing them and do not indicate the views or opinions of Ella One. None of the healthcare professionals in this podcast series endorse any medicinal brand or products. Welcome back to the My Morning After podcast, brought to you by Ella One, the most effective morning after pill. This is the pod that's smashing taboos like watermelons under a sledgehammer, except with even more juice. We're shedding light on the realities and truths of those morning after moments and proudly oversharing, because undersharing has been underserving women for far too long. If you have a story about emergency contraceptive experiences to share, or just want to find out more about the campaign, head to mymorningafter.co.uk. You're listening to the dulcet tones of Alex Fox, broadcaster, journalist, sex educator, and your host with the most. I hope you're having a day so delicious it could win a popular baking television show, and may it also be entirely devoid of soggy bottoms. In this ep, I'm joined by activist and law changer Gina Martin and journalist Coco Khan to give you the 411 on matters of sex. We also share one of your My Morning After stories with our guests and get their input. So, Gina, you are so much a beacon for feminism that I'm thinking of maybe renaming my vagina Vagina in your honour.
Oh my God, do it, please.
You are an activist and a writer who this year has changed the law. You're like Robocop. You are the law. You succeeded in making upskirting illegal. That's
so weird that you're saying that out loud. I'm still not used to it. So when other people say it, I'm like, yeah, did it.
Because it was a long slog, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like 18 months of work, pretty much every day for 18 months. Can't remember there being a weekend off or anything like that. And I had a full-time job as well, so yeah, it was really hard, but we got there in the end.
So now the act of taking a photograph up somebody's skirt without their consent is against the law, and failing to pause for even a nanosecond, you've moved straight on to writing a book called Be the Change, which is all about activism, and that's going to be published later this year.
Yes, in June. I'm really excited about it. It's a really good opportunity. I'm not like the type of person who's like, okay, I keep it close to my chest. I'm not going to tell you how I did it. I'm like, take it all so everyone else can do it as well.
Wearing appropriately popping lipstick next to you is Coco Khan, who is a columnist for The Guardian. And Coco, your words have appeared in the best-selling collection of essays, The Good Immigrant, the UK version of which contains stories from British-born people of colour. And more recently, you have also written in a book called It's Not About the Burqa, which came out last month, which I think makes you the Burqa Queen in some ways.
I believe so. A self-appointed title, but I'm sure one that everyone will agree with.
Oh, yeah.
I am the Queen of the Burqa.
Or talking about why that shouldn't be the central discussion when it comes to stereotypes about Muslim women's sexuality, faith, feminism and race.
Exactly, and that's why I'm the best queen for it, because I'm completely inept at the job. I don't really know what I'm talking about. And that's why I work. I'm very much a figurehead and have no real knowledge. And so, yeah, that's me. That's my jam over the last few weeks, going around, talking to people, saying, thank you for your questions about the burqa. I have no knowledge, because surprisingly, not all women are obsessed with the burqa if they are Muslim.
Yeah, appropriately enough, I think Muslim women's true identities and the huge range of identities that they encompass are very much shrouded in misconception, right? So what are some of the strangest misunderstandings about what it means to be a Muslim woman that you've heard of?
So I have a very strange relationship to my faith. I basically grew up and very much kicked against it. You know, I'm still someone who likes to have a drink, likes to party, likes to do bad things that when I was growing up made me, basically I had decided in my mind I couldn't be part of this faith. And the community around me gave me all the reasons to think that. They wanted to monitor my behavior. They wanted to tell me how to be, how to think. And I just, it didn't sit with me. So for a really long time, I didn't call myself a Muslim because I had decided they want to kick me out of the faith anyway, I'm out. And then a few years ago, when all the feeling of Islamophobia started happening in the UK, I had this moment where I realized it's a privilege for me to sit back and say it's not me, because it is me, isn't it? It is my sister, it is my mum, it is my family, it is my culture, it is my community. And even if they might have kicked me out, I still love them. I still got their back.
Well, opening up conversations and inviting multitudes of voices into them so that we can really understand topics from multiple points of view, different faiths, different cultural backgrounds, different personal experiences is what the My Morning After project is all about. We're encouraging women from all different backgrounds to share their personal tales of what's happened to them and what they've gone through regarding emergency contraception. So, do you want to just kick off by telling me a bit about what you both understand by the morning after pill? Or do you have any personal stories? Or
like, I don't walk into a pharmacy and I'm not embarrassed to ask about it because I feel like I'm taking control and responsibility of my own life. I don't see it as a shameful thing, but I didn't have any conversations about it growing up, apart from with my family, which is really weird. But then once I was getting on a flight with my friend to go to Australia, I was about 22, and I got on the tube and realized I'd left it. I was meant to take it that day and I'd left it at home. That day I was flying and I got on the tube with my friend and I got to the airport and I was staying in, this is a very long story, but I was staying in the storeroom of a pub like Harry Potter for 2 years because I had no money, but we'll get back to it another time. And the landlord of the pub that I was staying in, I contacted him and was like, I need this pill. Like, I have to take it. Can you get it? How do we get it to me? I'm at Stansted Airport. And he put it in a taxi and paid for it to go all the way to the airport. And the guy, and paid the guy to get out of the car with an envelope and give it to me at the airport. And I was like, that was such like a amazing moment for me because it was like, this guy's like a 60-year-old guy that I used to live with. Like this, I'm not related to him. He's like a lovely guy, pub landlord, quite, a, you know, typical what you'd imagine. Which is like a really lovely moment where it was like, okay, when it comes down to it, you can have those conversations with people if you really need to.
Do you know what? You've illustrated such a typical situation in so many people's lives in that when you are flying by the seat of your pants and you have a to-do list longer than Rapunzel's hair, often it is really easy to forget things. Yes. It doesn't make you an irresponsible person. It means just because of that nature of, as I say, flying by the seat of your pants, sometimes you might just accidentally maybe not do the things with the stuff in your pants that you're supposed to.
Exactly. Things slip. Like, we're human beings, you know, we make mistakes. And I think that's why it's so critical to have those conversations about it as well. Because as soon as you have this idea of, you know, all the things we deal with as women, as soon as you have this idea of like having to be on it and be, you know, absolutely flawless and, you know, you take the pills at the right time and you do all that stuff. How many of us have forgotten to take like contraception pills? I've tried different things, I've made mistakes, I've explored different avenues. Like, we all make mistakes. We're all human. So you need to have like really honest conversations about it. Otherwise, I don't think we get anywhere really.
Coco, were you told about emergency contraception or more broadly about contraception as a young person?
No. No, there was no conversations about contraception at all. I grew up in a very multicultural but predominantly Asian community in East London. It just wasn't spoken about, not really. Ultimately, if you're talking about contraception, you're talking about having sex outside of marriage. You shouldn't be having sex outside of marriage. And once you're married, you're meant to have a baby anyway, so why are you taking contraception? Obviously, you know, if you were to get married and you wanted to wait having children, then I think, yes, of course, conversations were being had in that space. But the idea that you weren't married and having those conversations was just a red flag. No, you weren't allowed to have them. And it's not like anyone expressly said you can't, but you just felt it internally. You felt, if I say this, the response is not going to be, okay, then Coco, have a seat. Let's talk about your emotions. And now you're ready to have sex. It would just be like, okay, get in your room, lock the door. You know, what's going on? Let me interrogate every friend that walks through the door because obviously they're a bad influence. And that was basically how it was.
But do you feel like you needed more information and education as a younger person about what your choices were in order for you to have power over your own body and your own decisions?
Obviously, okay, your first port of call might be your GP. It's your family GP. You don't really want to go to them. Okay, fine, you're going to go to the clinic. When is the clinic open? Okay, but I'm meant to be in sixth form. I'm meant to be at my job. I'm meant to be in school. Someone's going to notice I'm not around.
Increasingly, you can order things online, or you can test at home, or you can pay for contraceptives online and then get them delivered to a nearby pharmacy or wherever suits you. So the route to accessing and having greater choice in terms of what we do put in our bodies to help us, help facilitate the lives we want, is becoming smoother and smoother.
To make obtaining the morning after pill even more convenient, Ella One has launched Ella One Direct, a new online delivery service with same-day delivery options designed to provide people with an additional, straightforward way to purchase the morning after pill. You can order at ellaonedirect.co.uk.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it takes time. I don't know what year the emergency contraception was kind of introduced, but I feel like I remember. I feel like it was in my lifetime. I feel like I was in my late teens or something like that when it first, boom, here it is. Here is this groundbreaking thing. I mean, my mum never took emergency contraception. Of course not. She's from a different generation and she's a very good woman. You know, she didn't do stuff like that. So it really was, you felt like when I certainly did when I was, you know, first taking it, that it was something, oh, boldly going where no woman's been before, you know, and it was intimidating, it was daunting. But I think that's changing a lot now.
Can you tell me about some of the stories you've heard or your own personal experiences with the relationship between religion and sex or sexuality, and particularly with regards to knowledge about contraceptive options and the fact that I don't really see this spoken about in the media?
Yeah, so I think the first thing I would say is that obviously Islam is a religion, but a lot of the kind of things, the issues that BAME communities face is cultural, not necessarily because of their religion. We see problems with, you know, African Christian families having the same problems as African Muslim families. That's because it's an African problem. And so similarly, my family are Pakistani, so that's Muslim, but a lot of my Indian friends who are Sikh and Hindu also had the same thing, because we sort of share a culture, we share a history, and we share sort of certain norms. One of my friends, when I was growing up, I wrote about her in the Good Immigrant. She had to hide all her contraception. She had to hide all of her pills. Once her pills were discovered, she got thrown out of the house. So she was threatened to be made homeless. It was all very, very severe. And actually, you know, when we look at sexual health services, BAME women really bear the brunt of like austerity. Yeah. They bear the brunt of the cuts the most, because partly because of community reasons, but also because they're most likely to be skint, they're most likely to be poor, they're most likely to have childcare problems. They don't have the privileges to kind of just walk through life and walk into a shop and, you know, drop some money. They've got like a million things they've got to do, caring responsibilities, low paid work, you know, gig economy. So I think that, yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think there definitely needs to be more time and space given to communities, marginal communities on this issue, not least because they are the most affected by it.
Emergency contraception is often referred to as the morning after pill, but unlike the morning, for a lot of people, there isn't a lot of light shed on this subject. In order to try and rectify this, Ella One are inviting people to share their stories, and this one comes from Georgina, who's 25. She says,
I've taken the morning after pill twice, and I often find that people are surprised when I talk candidly about it. To some, it's an admission of guilt, that you messed up, that you were irresponsible. To me, this makes no sense. Irresponsibility is the lack of response of assertive action. No one feels irresponsible asking for cough medicine or plasters. The first time I took it, my biggest concern was catching a flight in 3 hours. I bounded into the chemist. My boyfriend agreed that he would split the cost with me, as it had been a joint endeavour. The pharmacist took me into a room that was basically a cupboard, asked me some basic questions, and then suggested I take the morning after pill. I was given the pill and away I went. I remember reading the small book that came with it on the train station platform, revealing that the exact science was unclear, but seemed to work significantly, often when taken correctly. Whatever science it was, I was grateful. The second time, the main struggle was parking somewhere near the 24-hour pharmacy, this time boyfriend in tow. This time I had fallen asleep without taking my pill. I remember being slightly more apprehensive, as the chemist was smaller and even a discreet request was clearly going to be heard by all. I pepped myself up with my "you are a responsible woman" chat and asked anyway. On this occasion, I was also asked about my drug usage, STIs, and expanding on what had happened. I swallowed it and thanked the pharmacist. Both of my experiences have been that of relief, of a bullet dodged, of a reset button pressed. Both incidents happened while in a long-term relationship, which may have reduced judgment in those who I interacted with. I have spoken candidly of my experience to others, not only to reduce stigma about this form of contraception, but also to reduce fear and myths around it, so that more women see it as an option they can take if their normal contraception has failed for whatever reason, and not as a personal failure.
Was there anything in that story that resonated for you guys?
Yeah, that the description of when you go and get it was like literally exactly my description. Although, interestingly, different experiences. And I find the inconsistency of when I've gone and got it, because I don't know how many times I've got it over the last 10 years, but it must be four, five. And each time's been entirely different. But also, I love that Georgina said about her boyfriend agreeing he'd split the cost with hers, it had been a joint endeavour, because I find that really quite annoying that often the cost falls on the woman, you know, on the one person. And with our bodies, we have no autonomy. Well, we're not given a lot of autonomy over our bodies and around the world, and, you know, in different ways, not given that autonomy or that agency. But then when you've made a mistake, it's like, right, this is entirely up to you. So you sort this out on your own. This cost should be split and the responsibility should be joined and there should be a solidarity there.
Okay, what did you think of Georgina's tale?
I just remember thinking, wow, what a responsible woman.
I know.
What a deeply responsible woman that she was. And I agree. The boyfriend splitting the cost, very egalitarian. So glad to see the world is changing at least even 1%. One boyfriend doing that is more than any boyfriend that was doing it when I was 17. So great. Yes. I mean, I know she's not 17. She's 25. That is a woman. But I was sort of touched by it, really.
Also that like swallowing, when she's like saying about what she had to go into and then she's like, but I swallowed it anyway and thanks to the pharmacist. It's like, that's such a critical line. It's like, it can be such an uncomfortable experience. And I'm very happy to talk about anything, you know, I'm very open with everything. But God, if you were, I just feel like, I feel bad for other women who have gone in who are way less comfortable about talking about sex and have to go in and have this experience. Like, you know, women wait till the pharmacy is empty just so they can say it, you know, and that's sad. It shouldn't be like that. Mm. You're making a really responsible decision to do that and you're taking control of your own life. That's great.
There's actually a statistic that said a quarter of women who were surveyed in some research that took place in June 2018 said that they would wait until nobody else was in a chemist before they asked for emergency contraception. Now, I live in quite a busy part of town. I'd be waiting a long time while people sorted out their diarrhea remedy. Their corn plasters and whatnot.
Also, we're so British, they'll be like, no, you go first. No, for 3 years. On that note with the timing, I think the guilt gets worse the longer you leave it, because I've gone in like an hour after and I've also gone in like 70 hours after. And when they're like, so when did this happen? You're like, 72 hours ago. I don't want to say it. I'm like, it's fine. It was an hour ago and I'm on it and I'm here. But then sometimes, you know, you make mistakes. Like you say, things slip out of your mind. Things, you know, go wrong, or you're busy, or there's something you can't get out of or whatever. The guilt gets so much worse when you've left it a long time. And I don't know why. Even as a 27-year-old woman, I'm like, oh God, I'm so sorry.
You can only take the morning after pill the morning after, right? Wrong. It's a bit of a misleading nickname, to be honest. But you're not alone in thinking that. 62% of 2,500 women aged between 16 and 54 who were surveyed in July 2014 thought that you had to take the morning after pill within 24 hours of intercourse. In fact, you can take levonorgestrel within 72 hours and uloprostyl acetate, aka LR1, within 120 hours. You can also take it at any time, not just in the morning.
A lot of the emotions that you've spoken about here, though, guilt, humiliation, taking one for the team by being too upstanding, I hate the word outspoken, but speaking out women who are choosing to share their own experiences. The more we do talk about these things, the less guilt-ridden and shame-associated that they get, which is why it is so important that we all open up about them.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. The process of like, the questions that they ask you, I know they have to do it for medical reasons, of course, but there is this tinge of, and how many partners have you had? And where are they from? Like, I don't know, what? Surrey? Is that okay? I don't know. Just say the home counties, it's safe. I don't know. Like, I don't know. I can't wait for the pill to come out for men. And then they can have that moment where the doctor's like, and how many partners have you slept with, Jonathan? And they'll just be like, 33, lads, yeah.
Shot.
That's just not going to happen, is it?
Didn't they do a trial with the male contraceptive pill and they had the same symptoms as women, and this might not be true so we could cut it out, but I'm pretty sure they did a trial and they had really bad symptoms in terms of like back pain and stomach pain and mood swings, etc., and they stopped the trial because there was so much pushback because of the symptoms.
Early trials have been done on male contraceptive, hormonal contraceptives. There is another potential form of male long-acting reversible contraceptive that's in the works. Have you heard of Vasal Gel?
No. Sexy sounding.
This is, isn't it just?
Vasal Gel.
It doesn't go on your hair, it goes down there. It's a gel that is injected into the vas deferens, that's the tube that actually takes sperm up from the ball sack and down the rest of the railway track, if you will. And this gel blocks that that tube temporarily, well, for as long as it's there, it blocks that tube so that a man can still ejaculate, but there is no sperm in the ejaculatory fluid. So in theory, it can't get you pregnant. If he and his partner decide that they want to try and start a family in a biological way, a second fluid can be injected and it flushes it out. But unfortunately, so far, lots of men have said that they wouldn't do that because they don't want to be
injected in the
jabbed
penis.
In the nutsack. Yeah.
I'm not surprised.
I mean, when you get the implant, you get jabbed.
Oh, the implant is the
arm,
worst.
Not in the nuts, so appreciate it slightly different. A friend of mine recently had her implant taken out, and she said because she had her implant taken out, she had a period, which she hadn't had for a very long time. And it was actually really nice to hear a woman talk about how great it was to have a period.
She was like,
I had my period, it was amazing. And I basically had my period shortly after, strangely early, I think, because she was talking about it. So it was in my mind. And I had my period.
I'm not quite sure that the menstrual cycle works that way, Coco.
Science. That is not science.
Disclaimer, not science.
Disclaimer, not science. Made that up. And it was around the time of the super blood moon. And I remember a moment just bleeding, just being outside in the countryside, bleeding in the super blood moon out. And I was just like, I'm
alive.
I'm supernatural. I thought I was going to howl at the moon. It was kind of amazing.
That's cool. I like that.
And after that super blood moon, I literally had a period every time the moon was out, like I was an old, like ye oldie witch.
You should have got a moon chart.
I know.
So good.
Gina, in your family, it sounds like sex was pretty openly talked about. It was an open book and an open door when it came to asking questions. Whereas Coco, with you, things were a little bit more closed off. It's a shame, really, that sex education at school didn't, for want of a better phrase, fill that void.
It's funny, I don't remember any sex education from school, and I don't know if that was because it didn't happen or because I truanted. I truanted quite a lot at school.
You were off getting the morning after pill.
Yeah,
you were busy.
I wasn't actually. I lost my virginity really late. And actually...
do you define as really late? Because I hear this a lot. People's concept of what late is to have intercourse for the first time is completely out of touch with what the reality
18.
Is. 18. No, that's not late at all.
Why is that?
Just because I didn't want to have sex with anyone unless I was like super into them.
That's so sweet because was the other way. I was like, I didn't want to have sex. But just couldn't find anyone interested.
Wait, 21. Okay, that's almost said I was like, no, I was 17. No, I wasn't. Okay, 21. Yeah.
I think the most regrettable aspect of my first penetrative sex experience wasn't who I was with, who was a wonderful long-term boyfriend, who I'm still pals with, actually.
Aww.
But the furniture on which I lost it, which was this truly hideous fold-out neon orange floral sofa bed. It was hideous. I'm surprised. I mean, they say that too much masturbation makes you go blind. I'm amazed that I didn't go blind during the loss of my virginity just based on that fabric alone. But then my mum flogged it. Do you remember those free papers called Loot, where you could like buy and sell things? My mum sold this secondhand, and this guy came round to pick it up, and I remember watching him wedge this sentimental sofa into his white van, and thinking how blessed I was that my first sexual experience was less awkward than him trying to ram that chair into a vehicle.
Also, as a side point, how fascinating that the language around losing your virginity is when I lost it when you're a woman.
Yeah.
And like with guys, that's not always prevalent. I found that really interesting.
Oh, I think guys say that
my cousins got told that when they became a man.
What a weird thing to say.
That is that not a thing?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's like,
became a man
last
night.
You're a man now.
What a weird thing to say.
Were you before? An amorphous blob. Well,
that's what I'm like. Like, what did that mean before you had sex?
Oh, weird. That's weird, mate.
Isn't
honestly,
it?
That's weird, yeah.
I stepped into your manhood.
Stepped into your manhood. That feels like you'd really need to clean your shoe thoroughly afterwards.
Sorry, can I just say a serious point here?
Yes.
Serious point. One thing that I learned from my sex education, which I didn't have, but I wish I did have, was that when I was growing up, basically, you did it or you didn't do it. If you did it, you were a bad girl, you were a rebel, you were cool, which is kind of the group I wanted to be in, but unfortunately wasn't quite cool enough to get in. Or there were like the good girls, and the good girls were, for me, the Asian squad that were very good, and they were all going to be great dental hygienists, and I'm sure they're very lovely and they probably own their own houses. But and I wanted to be in this other squad. And actually now I look back being like, it's so wrong that like sex at a young age becomes, it should just be normal. It's just a thing that happens. You ate dinner, You have sex, you have sexy feelings.
If you want to.
The fact there's all this kind of like emotion about it. It's like, yeah, I'm going to have sex and that is going to define me as a person. And that's going to, I mean, of course it is a defining experience, but definitely what I wish there was more of was just normalization.
Mm-hmm.
You wake up, you sleep, you go to work, you have sex. That's it. Yeah. That's fine.
100%. We just keep circling back to this point of open, honest communication and conversation.
Yeah.
Would remove so much stigma and so much pressure. Going back to this idea, Gina, of lost virginity, I hate that term.
I do too.
I actually, for a start, you're not losing anything.
You're gaining something.
You're gaining an experience, if should you wish to.
Yeah.
Nobody is a lesser person because of the sexual experience they have or haven't had. But also I find the concept of virginity full stop quite a strange one.
So do I.
Because it's like we set this barrier that you cross when you have a penetrative experience, mm-hmm. but anything leading up to that or that doesn't fit that very strict definition of sex doesn't count. And that leads to, I hear from a lot of young people who are highly confused about whether or not they actually are virgins because, for example, they've had
sexual sex as well.
Yeah.
Like, we don't talk about any other type of sex.
One of the things that used to happen all the time, and this is 100% true, and no one will ever tell you this, but loads of the girls I was growing up with, they wanted to have sex because, you know, they had feelings or whatever. So they were like, oh, it's all right, we'll just do anal. Mm-hmm. And obviously you're living in these really strict families where you can't even have someone of the opposite gender walk through the door, let alone be in a bedroom with the door shut. What? No. So there was no place to have the sex. So everybody just used to do it in cars.
That's not good.
Yeah. And it'd be so weird. You'd just be like walking around like la 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 the East End and just go past a like shaking car and be like,
oh God. Was that because if you didn't have it penetratively, then you haven't lost your virginity?
Exactly.
No way.
Yeah.
That is fascinating.
I hear that from a lot of young people. It's partly because they believe that they can't get pregnant through anal sex. Yeah. Certainly harder to get pregnant, but not impossible. Anytime that there is any...
What?
Mum didn't tell me that. Anytime that there is semen in the vicinity of the genitals, it's not impossible. It's my job to make that really clear because, you know, if there's lots of fooling around without a condom on there or without any other type of contraception, then it's always a possibility. It's not unheard of.
I find it fascinating with all of this stuff, everything we're talking about. I'm learning so much from this conversation. Surely... I was lucky in terms of sexual education because my mum and dad sat me down and had a conversation about sex with, there was a book and there was photos and they went through everything. And I remember being the next day being like, oh my God, that was the weirdest conversation I've ever had in my life. I think I was like 12, 13. But if I hadn't had that at school, it would have been a slideshow with a picture of man, picture of woman and them saying something about intercourse.
Yeah, don't even slide in the slides, do they?
And it's like so medical and there's no emotional conversations. Mm. And also the only things that you hear that are emotional are generally negative, which is like the fact that we are told, oh, it's going to really hurt when you have sex for the first time. And that's just normal to deal with it. Like all these kind of things are like the negative associations if they're emotional and the rest is just fully medical. But there was nothing in school. And especially what there was, so much of it, I think, was formatted through the male gaze. And that's a problem we have in general with a lot of our industries and a lot of our conversations that is there all through the lens of, you know, male eyes and benefit patriarchal structure anyway. But imagine having sex education through both male and female gaze.
As I hear you both talking about your personal experiences and stuff you've heard from friends, it strikes me that often when we talk about things like contraception and sex, we talk about best case scenarios and ideal behaviour.
Yeah.
And maybe we need to be a bit more realistic. Maybe, you know, if we have more conversations of this nature that are actually realistic about the holistic, contraception doesn't work in isolation, doesn't it? It's not something that exists in a bubble. It's one part of our multifarious lives.
Yes.
So maybe we need to consider it from more angles.
That's an interesting dichotomy as well with, you know, medical profession, medical industry. It's like, it's very formulaic. It has to be. It's science, effectively. It's biology. So it's very formulaic. And then you have it coming towards and being a tool for regular people who are totally fallible, always mess up, always make mistakes, and I just try and do their best and all are not homogenous and have incredibly different experiences. So that meeting is obviously, there's in between that, there has to be serious conversation and a good dialogue. Otherwise, how does it work?
It is fascinating that people are so weird about sex and talking about
it. Oh my God, it is so fascinating.
Like,
all of us are here because somebody got it on.
Yeah, like, sex is the world's most popular form of transport. It's how we all arrived here.
Yes.
Oh, that's nice. When you started saying that, I was like, what?
Alex
what
has lost
sort of
it, guys.
What sort of sex move is this? I don't understand. I know I'm out of touch with modern sexual ways, but what? You travel?
What is transcendental.
Yeah. It's the most normal thing in the world and yet the biggest, hardest thing to talk about often.
Well, I often talk about wrapping things up because I am big into condoms. But in this context, I am going to have to draw the conversation to a close. Well, the morning after pill is often something that people don't really give much thought to until the morning after. However, knowledge is power. So hopefully through our chatterations and natterations today, we've given people a little bit more insight so that if and when the moment arrives when they might need that knowledge, they have it in their heads and in their beds. To keep up with this podcast, please do subscribe and follow. And for the latest news and conversations from Ella One, seek out at Ella One UK on Twitter and Instagram. Hello One, hello yes. If you have a morning after story to share, you can do so at mymorningafter.co.uk or by using the hashtag #mymorningafter. Join in, join us, and join together in rejecting the unhelpful and unwarranted stigma surrounding emergency contraception. My Morning After, putting taboo to bed.